food addictions even to foods that can be healthy, quick highs even to activities that can be healthy and beneficial for your body, and compulsive behaviors. Welcome to the Vital Veda Show. Immerse in a shared experience with me of exploring exciting realms of holistic health and the rich, expansive field of consciousness of which underlies and encompasses everything. It is here that we explore the essence of what health and vitality truly is. Get ready to discover how to enliven your ultimate potential for health and to live life in a frictionless flow while achieving more. You deserve to feel vitality. As a matter of fact, it is innate within you. Welcome to the Vital Veda Show. For those who don't know, I am Dylan Smith-Yo, a Vedic practitioner and holistic health educator based in Sydney, Australia, but I travel around. We'll be talking a bit about that. And yeah, my passion is to share wisdom and knowledge with you. And my passion is also to study it and make it applicable for you to hear. This is really ancient wisdom, which is time-tested for more than millennia. People say Ayurveda is for thousands of years, but really it is for so much longer. It's actually as old as nature. Ayurveda, for those who don't know, is a Sanskrit word. Ayur means life. Veda means science. Ayurveda is the science of life. Such a holistic, broad body of knowledge. And there's so much. It's really essentially the laws of nature. That's what the Veda is. Anyway, you can read about that on my website, in the blog, and in other podcasts. But, you know, it's necessary to talk about Ayurveda because not all my episodes are strictly on Ayurveda. It's really coming from different perspectives on health, holistic health. But today I'm with one of the quite a predominant Ayurvedic teacher and face for Ayurveda, particularly in the West, Myra Lewin. Grew up in USA. She's from USA. Lived there basically her whole life and moved to New Zealand very recently, like right about now. So if you're listening to this on time, you may catch Myra on her Australian tour. Just check out halepule.com for that. She's currently in Melbourne as I record this, and yeah, you may catch her at the end of her tour. Otherwise, go visit her in New Zealand. Like many healers and proponents of Vedic wisdom and healing wisdom, Myra embraced the power of yoga and Ayurveda when her career as a corporate executive, basically screwed up her health. And the prognosis of being in this corporate system where she had been diagnosed with an incurable disease, as they said, forced her to seek some holistic lifestyle and holistic help. And that's what got into Ayurveda. And, you know, she founded Halepule, which is a yoga and Ayurveda institute. She founded that in 1999. And a lot of people go there. I've met a lot of people go there and they have wonderful experiences. It's a big focus on food and treatments and farm lifestyle, really beautiful back to earth nature environment. Myra is the author of two books, Freedom in Your Relationship with Food and Simple Ayurvedic Recipes. And, you know, she studied with some of the world's most prominent practitioners of yoga and Ayurveda, including Sunil Joshi, David Frawley, Robert Svoboda, Myra Tirui, Vasant Lad, Patabali Joyce, Richard Freeman, among others. And she's spoken at several conferences all around the world. She leads yoga teacher trainings and Ayurvedic trainings and immersions all around the world, including her new home base of New Zealand, and offers health consultations, dosha balancing treatments, a lot. I decided to ask Myra about one of the things she's been talking a lot about, which is addictions. And I'm not just talking drugs, alcohol, sex addictions. I'm talking about addiction to things that can even be healthy. Addictions to food is a big one, especially for a lot of people listening to this, whether it's snacking and, coffee, sweets. I can't go without having that chocolate. I'm not satisfied unless I have chocolate after that meal. And then in India, I'm not satisfied unless I have yogurt after my meal, a pile of yogurt on my rice after dinner, which really in Ayurveda, yogurt is prohibited at night because it's abhishandi, which means it blocks the channels and, you know, it's quite heavy food and it's prohibited at night. So these people are addicted. Some people are addicted to sleep after food. Even if they sleep, then they can't, if they don't sleep after food, they can't function. And this is a really bad habit. Sleeping during the day is never advised, only in certain circumstances, like for the sick and for the elderly. People can even be addicted to adrenaline to exercise, need to get this. Really, all these things are external factors for fulfillment. You should not need anything external. You should have that state of being established all the time. And even if it's a healthy thing like exercise or a health food, you shouldn't rely on it. You shouldn't be solely relying on it. Definitely, we should use these things regularly and, you know, but you shouldn't be using coffee as energy or this food as energy or exercise as a way to give to wake you up from feeling down. You know, you should have that established, and that should just be a kind of bonus. So really, when we go down to the core of addictions, the stress is a cause, and also loneliness can be caused to pick up these habits and kind of rely on these things to fulfill you. So this is a fun and short casual conversation with Myra. Before we get into it, I just want to let y'all know about what's coming up. So, you know, my passion is to travel around the world and share wisdom of the ancients because it's so relevant right now in today's age. So I'm going to be in New York City in July, and I'm going to be in Boulder, Colorado in July. I'm going to be offering workshops, wisdom sessions, one-on-one treatments, consultations, and they're booking out fast, especially Boulder in Colorado. I'm basically nearly booked out for one-on-one sessions. So jump on the Vital Veda website under events, click on USA Tour, and you can get all the details for that. Talking about USA, my guru, my teacher, Dr. Raju, one of the few Vedas, Ayurvedic doctors, part of a family of Ayurvedic doctors that have been healing for many generations and that have this pure knowledge. Dr. Raju is in right now in USA. He's going to be visiting Fairfield in Iowa. He's going to be visiting LA and New York City. So for those details, you're going to have to email me because it's only via email. It's not online. And he'll be offering pulse consultations. They are masters in pulse diagnosis, as well as the famous banana treatment. Now, for those who've been following me on Instagram, Story has been seeing all these amazing testimonials I've been receiving from women about the banana treatment. This is a treatment exclusive and unique to this family. We just offered it in Australia a couple weeks ago, not even. That is the reason the Raja family travels the world, is to give this absolutely profound treatment for women. And yeah, I'm going to read you some of the testimonials. Why not? Because I've just been receiving, and it's really beautiful. So Julia says, by the end of my period, because she did the banana treatment during her period, which is ideal, but you don't have to. By the end of my period, I was on cloud nine. I have never experienced anything as powerful as banana treatment. Bryony also said, from Sydney, it is the most powerful purification I have ever done. Thank you so, so much, Dylan. I can't wait to do it again. Thanks, Bryony. Debbie, also from Sydney, said, the time since my banana treatment has honestly been incredible. I feel really tapped into my energy, my creative potential, and something has also shifted in the way men are drawn to me, all of which would make sense when the healing took place. I also got my period this morning, which was a bit of a surprise, as I had none of the usual signs that warn me that it's on my way. I had no weight gain or water retention, no irritability or feeling very emotional. I've been sleeping just fine, even though I usually don't. And most importantly, I had zero cramps, pain or crippling fatigue when my period arrived. It's honestly a miracle. Thank you, Debbie, for sharing. This is an amazing treatment. This is the biggest inspiration for me to bring my teachers, the Raja family, to Australia every year. And while I promote them traveling the world and support them traveling the world, to offer this, because usually women travel to India for it. Literally, a woman will fly from Australia or England or the US to India for 5 days, get the treatment, go back to their country. And obviously not many people do that, only the devoted and those who are aware of this and appreciate it a lot and really need it, like those suffering from serious gynecological issues, infertility, so many things. But that is why we bring it. And, you know, we had, I don't know, over 200 people do it in Australia in 2 weeks recently. And as well as US, it's being offered in Bali right now in Canggu. Again, for that, email me in case you're listening on time. Otherwise, sign up to my newsletter. I keep regularly where the Rajas are around the world and offering profound treatments like the banana treatment as well as the pulse consultation. We plan to be offering banana treatment once again in Australia at the end of June, as well as New Zealand for the first time at the very beginning of July. Not only banana treatment, but also pulse consultations and lectures with Dr. Raj. So sign up to the Vital Veda newsletter on the Vital Veda website, and you'll be informed when the Rajus are in your country. All right, there's just so many amazing testimonials about banana treatment. Just check it out on my website, type in banana purification, read the article, read what it's all about. It's basically a profound purification for women, all women, even if there's no health issues. So today's episode with Myra Lewin is pretty awesome. It's a pretty chilled, casual chat and a bit of a taste into Myra's wonderful offerings, where she does a lot of offerings. You can experience yourself at Hale Pule, which is her Ayurvedic institute. This podcast episode brought to you by Vital Veda took a lot of work, particularly, as does many other episodes. And I do it for the love. I do it for the free. I pay to do it. And my best mate, Ari, came to help me a lot with this episode. There were some tech issues and he spent an hour or two and after his full day of work. So we really require some support. Now, the best support you can do is share this episode. And don't just sit there passively thinking, yeah, someone else would do that. I just like listening to the knowledge. Why don't you take action and share this episode with someone? Send it to someone. Send another episode of the Vital Veda podcast to someone that you like. Share a screenshot of it on your Instagram story. Rate and review and subscribe. That would be awesome. That would help the podcast not fall into the ether. This is so that we can share with everyone and really helps me to continue doing this. As I said, you know, don't just be passive and stand there. When you do stuff like this, when you help support me and this show and everyone else that it can benefit, you will feel fantastic. Trust me, when you take that little surrendering, that preference of, oh, I'd rather sit here and just be passive, do that. I ain't just telling you about the reviews and about the ratings. I want you to feel good from it. It's a good thing to take your time and do that. So that helps a lot. I even had a random donation the other day by someone. They had my bank account details. That was very kind. I don't usually ask for those, but hey, if you want, reach out. I'll let you know how to do that. But again, thank you all so much for listening. Don't forget to check out all the other episodes. There's so many episodes. Not so many, but I really want to be doing so many. It's just a lot of work. And I'm trying to do this every month, and I'm even struggling to get one a month. I started off doing once a fortnight and moved it to once a month because it's a big job podcasting and I got a lot on. Anyway, I love it. That's why I do it. And I'm so glad that you are listening. So I hope you're resonating. I hope you're vibing. Enjoy. And one more thing I forgot to say. Don't forget to listen to this whole episode, because at the end of it, we got a little treat for you. So I'm with Myra. So good to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
And we're in Tamarama, one beach away from me on Eastern Sydney. How do you like
being here? Lovely place. Oh, just beautiful. Yeah. The rocks and the trees and the ocean all together, and lovely people too.
And being on the east coast, are you on the east coast in Hawaii? Or?
On the east coast of the island of Kauai, yes.
Good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you see sunrise above the horizon.
Sunrise, yes.
Beautiful. Okay. So tell us about yourself. How did you get into Ayurveda and yoga?
Okay. I got involved in meditation first, actually. And I had a wonderful teacher named Jack Kornfield. And he would have regular gatherings. And we would meditate for 50 minutes. And then he would talk for 50 minutes. And I really loved his talks, and I was so tortured by sitting. It was very difficult for me. And so that took me actually to yoga asana. And then from there, from my yoga teacher, actually, I learned about Ayurveda. And when it was first presented to me, I was like, oh, that's a little too complicated. I'm healthy. It's okay. And then some friends convinced me that I needed to try ghee and that it was going to help me a lot. And it really did. Yeah, and so then from there, I was pretty convinced, actually. And it's just continued to grow and expand in my life since then. So, yeah. And my studies and work started in the United States, where I was living at the time. And I was worked with a man named David Frawley and Robert Svoboda and a woman named Saraswati Berman. And so I learned a great deal in the beginning, actually, by my own treatment, what was happening with me and learning about myself. And then from there, it was really very much about implementing it in life. And then my clinical studies were with Sunil Joshi in Nagpur in India.
Mm-hmm. And how was it learning with David Frawley? to start?
He's a philosopher. Mm. I mean, and he's an encyclopedia, I like to say. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's fantastic, incredible information in that. Not really a clinician mm-hmm. in that. So I learned tremendous amount of information. And in the beginning, you know, he would talk about things, and honestly, usually I would pass out. And it would take me hearing it a couple of times at least before it actually could sink in. And so it's been really great over the many years now to hear him speak at other times too, number one, because he's changed and his speaking is so beautiful now. And at that time it was pretty new for him. And also I'm a better listener.
How has he changed now? Because I see him now, he's talking a lot about politics and Hinduism and Indian as a national country. And
And he can also, but he can talk, he's able to talk, at least from my assessment, he's able to speak about things in a way that I think that more people can understand it. Mm. Yeah, so when he talks about Ayurveda and its relationship to Jyotish, for example, and its relationship to yoga, in the beginning it was he was so deeply in it in terms of studying it that it was more difficult to talk about maybe.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and who else have been significant teachers on your path?
I would say Dr. Joshi, yeah, because he taught me about looking, you know, really looking at people, you know, that's what we need to do, and to be fully present with them. And also working with him helped me to see how important it is that I'm present in my own practices. So one of the big things that took me back to was that whatever practices I'm doing, I need to not be habitual about it. I need to be really present in it. And that's made a big difference then in my ability to look at people, to talk to people, and find out what's going on, so that we can find the best treatment for them and the best practices for them.
That's a really good point you made, is giving your attention, and we call in Ayurveda or the Veda soma, giving your soma to the patient. That's probably maybe one of the most important factors in healing is your compassion, your attention. Mm-hmm. You can have the best medicines and the best recommendations, but as a practitioner, having that relationship and connection is so vital. And
that's one of the reasons that we at Halipuli, that we do the work the way we do it. So we keep things small and quite personal when we do trainings, when we work with people in Panchakarma or other treatment. Yeah.
That's beautiful. I admire that intimacy. Yeah. Like even here, you're on your Australian tour and you limit to 6 people or in this class and this, which is really nice. Mm-hmm. A change to what I'm used to of being an Indian, very busy clinic and patient, and we do, you know, quick consultations. So it's really beautiful to do that. And how do you teach your students and people to increase that ability to give that soma to a patient and connect with them? It seems maybe through their own inner development first.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, when we're training people, we actually have them in our courses, we have them do a little program that is all about implementing Ayurveda in your daily life. You know, so with your ahar, your diet, and your vihar, your lifestyle, and those kinds of things, and understanding the why of that. And then from there, people can start to grow, because then when they start learning all the details and all the academic information about Ayurveda, then they can actually put it into context. So that's one part, and then the other part is obviously then their own practices and the depth of that. And are they willing to go to a place when sometimes when I'm working with new practitioners, you know, they'll have me look at something with a client, and when I look at it and I say, okay, well, I would have asked about these things, and you know, those things might be things they're uncomfortable with, and so that's the kind of thing when we're training people that we start talking about. You know, you don't have to know everything, but you can ask somebody a question to see if they can think about it themselves. Yeah.
What are some of the aspects in today's society that you feel need attention from healers and practitioners and people who want to, you know, increase the collective consciousness?
Right.
What areas in society?
Ooh, I can think of two areas in particular that where we can really make a big difference. One is that when you have that person who's just barely interested, you know, they have a little bit of interest, but a little bit scared. And I think one of the best things we can do is just give them one thing. Just give them a little bit of an opening, and don't give them too much. And then because then they'll come back and they'll come back. So, you know, when somebody has a lot of tamas in their life, you know, where they're participating things that are maybe of not of the highest nature and things like that, you know, that not to say all that stuff, oh, you got to give all that up, or oh, that's so bad, but more so to say, you know, what's something of them that has more light in it that we could suggest, so that we start that approach that way. And then the other thing, and these are somewhat related, is that people are suffering a lot with a lot of strong attachments, I'll say, and addiction. And it just, you know, it's the gamut these days. It's so many different things. And you know, so when we understand the holistic nature of Ayurveda, we understand that that's happening because there's disconnection from self. There's disconnection from ourselves as eternal spirit. But starting at that point with a lot of people is not going to get you anywhere. So, you know, finding just, if they come to you, obviously, you know, then you have an opening. But finding out where is the greatest pain, and then what can we do to give some relief there? And finding things just where they can maybe turn away from some of those tamasic things, those lower vibration activities and exposure even.
Yeah.
And just reducing that and starting to shift more toward things that have a little higher vibration.
Mm. Yeah. And I find even some people, you don't even tell them to reduce it. Just bring the sattva, just bring the light activities, and naturally the tamas, the darkness will
go. Yes, yeah. Exactly.
You don't want to tell someone who's waking up at 9 a.m. or later and watching TV and eating whatever to say, get up at sunrise and do 13 Surya Namaskars and meditate. Like, you need to take it easy and
right.
slowly bring it. Okay, beautiful.
You know, what really prompts that strong attachment and addiction in us is when, you know, it's one thing if, you know, I have a really strong preference for something. Oh, I really love that. And I would talk about it in that tone of voice. But then when somebody starts talking about it and their voice gets really loud and their eyes get big and that, then you know, you're dealing with something else. And you know, really what it comes to is that we get uncomfortable about things, right? Anything. It can be that we have a samskara and somebody does something or reminds us of it, a samskara being that impression or memory, and somebody reminds us of that, and that wakes up in us, and we get really uncomfortable. You know, or a lot of us can be just generally uncomfortable. We're uncomfortable in relating with others. We're uncomfortable in new situations or feeling like we're in the unknown, for example. And then we start doing something to avoid the discomfort. And so we get that little bit of relief from it, you know, whether it's, you know, having a drink of alcohol, or it's spending the evening on Netflix, or, you know, it can be just anything where we avoid that discomfort or we try to run away from it. And so that's, we keep doing that because that discomfort's going to keep coming up. And then we get attached to that because we keep thinking that, well, it worked for a second. It's just that, you know, over time it doesn't work that well anymore and it's not enough. And so that's when we do that, then that's when the tamas starts to really build, even in people that we wouldn't describe that way. You know, we'd say, oh, you know, no, they're of a little higher nature. And then before you know it, though, they're kind of going down this slippery slope of not being able to say no to something. You know, and sometimes this happens with people in relationships, you know, that we stay in a relationship because we keep thinking that we're going to get some kind of relief that we might have gotten for a few seconds right in the beginning. Or when we thought that this other person, for example, was our picture of what we wanted them to be, and then we start finding out who the person really is, and it doesn't fit our picture, and then there's a lot of disappointment, but we'll just keep grasping in that same direction or trying to control various things like that. Yeah.
So that's like using these, whatever they are, rajasic or tamasic things. It seemed to be more rajasic, maybe.
They start out that way, right? Yeah, and then it heads, then it goes in the direction of tamas, yeah.
And that's to cover up the darkness. And what about quick highs? When it doesn't have to be drugs or alcohol, like even exercise or...
Right.
I don't know. It's people... Can you explain those? Because it seems people may be unstable with having that state of being established and they need other things, whether it's seeking even from a guru or getting a darshan from seeing someone just quick. They need all these things because they don't have an unstable state.
A good sense of self. Well, let's go back to tamas, rajas, and sattva, right? So we know there's not a lot of sattva in that situation. And the rajas is even of the right kind, but it gets to be too much. So that's part of it, and that too much, you know, it can exhaust us, it will burn us out. But you know, people, and I've dealt with a lot of this, where people get really addicted to excitement. So they get addicted to the they want the excitement of going and buying something new.
Yeah.
The excitement of a new boyfriend or a new girlfriend, or the excitement of changing jobs. All of that, and it's really the addiction to the adrenaline. That's the high, and I've also dealt with a lot of people who have that addiction to that adrenaline that comes with creating negative drama, because that's what they grew up with. So you know, those kinds of things, we still have to deal with it in the same way. You know, we find ways to bring a little bit of sattva in and try to reduce the tamas and rajas in the mind. But, you know, the first thing, the best thing is always you need to take away the thing. Now, how do you take away? You can't take away the adrenaline, but you can bring it into their awareness. And, you know, most of the time, actually, people, you know, they don't ever think of that. And then if it's brought to their attention, then they start to see where they're doing it. Especially, you know, if they're talking to somebody about it, then they have some interest in feeling better, that they know there's something wrong. Yeah. The hardest area is when somebody's still in denial about it. Then you just wait until there's enough pain.
Can we just touch on some things to increase that sattva for people who want to transition to that?
Right. Well, the first thing is to reduce and eliminate whatever that thing is. And so, for example, if it's just being addicted to the drama, to the negative problems, is to go over with somebody what are some of the things that you can do instead, and even to the point of asking your friends to point it out to you if you start down that path. Yeah, so
is it like people who complain and love to complain, and even about their health, they're always...
Yeah, it's always a problem. Yeah. Or they're always blaming somebody else for something that happens to them. So that's a good one. And then, in the case of food or even alcohol or drugs, some of that can get a little bit more intense, but that we start to make some substitute actions. So what can you do? Well, when I get uncomfortable and I just want to go eat and I know I'm eating emotionally, then what can I do? Well, I can chant mantra. I could go for a walk. I can stop and take 12 deep breaths and smile to myself, and maybe I'll feel a little better. And that actually works pretty well if you actually do it. Just so they're really simple things like that. Sometimes it might be to talk to a friend that who will understand, and also to start to provide comfort in a different way. Yeah, because sometimes it's comfort, like we think, oh, I get some comfort from eating that food. But also people recognize that they get comfort out of the familiarity of whatever they're doing. And so introducing new things in really small ways on a regular basis and bringing that awareness to, oh, I can be okay in new situations. It could be anything. It could be just taking a walk on a new street or meeting a new person, and just letting yourself practice that and getting more comfortable with it, that also helps a great deal. Because when someone gets caught up in addiction, then they get really uncomfortable outside of that framework. And so we want to just start to expand the world a little bit, just a small bit at a time.
Beautiful. And can we go a bit more into food addictions? Because, you know, alcohol, drug addictions are one thing, but I guess most of the people listening to this would be more with the food addictions, whether right. it's sweets or whether it's mm-hmm. people eating 45 every half an hour. I mean, that can also be a metabolic issue mm-hmm. when they don't have a good sustainable source of fuel.
Yeah.
Food
addiction, it comes about usually with that discomfort. Now, I will say that there's some other things that have promoted that. You mentioned one of them, which is when people eat too often, then the Agni, the digestive fire, can't really do its job, and you're never satiated, never satisfied. And I think that that came about with a lot of changes in diet, and that there's quite a history behind that. And especially having grown up in the United States and seeing all that happen. So the medical industry started recommending people to eat real frequently and that, but it was because there were such poor changes in the diet prior to that that came about, that people's blood sugars were going up and down. So that's how it happened. But then, so when people become attached to particular foods or the effect that it brings, then we start to justify it in our mind that this is really going to make a difference. And of course, it gives you that brief moment of distraction, let's call it. So the notion that I become addicted to food, you know, people say, well, I have to eat all the time. How does that happen? And it has more to do with, again, relieving that discomfort. I'm going to put that thing in my mouth and it distracts me for one thing. I have a momentary taste that happens, and that's going to go in whatever direction it goes. When people started eating, they said they wanted to have a plant-based diet. And then what happened, though, is that everybody went toward what we call extractive foods, foods that have more bitter, pungent, and astringent tastes. And because people stopped chewing well, then that also contributed to the metabolic problems. And when that happened, then people said, oh, now it's the grains that cause the problem, or oh, it's the wheat that causes the problem. Well, you know, these are heavier foods, and if you don't chew them, there's going to be a problem. It doesn't matter what the quality of them is. And so when that shift happened, people were having foods with mostly bitter, pungent, astringent tastes, and we know that that's going to increase vata. That's going to cause tremendous imbalance and have you not feel grounded. And when you don't feel grounded, what do? You start looking for the sweet taste. You look for weight. And that sent people towards sugary food. Mm. And that whole shift has been pretty disastrous, I would say, for the health and well-being of people, at least in the modern world. And so, you know, with Ayurveda, we're starting to be able to explain it to people and to show people how they can move that in a different direction. So often when people have addictions, especially to things like, well, chocolate is one, for example. This is a big one today. It's been interesting to watch the marketing campaign that happened with that and to just watch it go like a swoosh that went over things. Because that bitter taste, you know, people get really, really attached to it, and then the sugar with it, and that's still taking them in that direction of not feeling grounded. Yeah. And so back to what you had mentioned, then there's no foundation. There's nothing to work with. And I always like to think of it, it's like somebody being a flag sort of flipping around on a pole and not having anything that keeps you grounded. So what we do then is that we have to bring some of that weighty food back in. But the simplest thing is the starting point, because almost invariably the people are not chewing the food.
Yeah, is that because of smoothies and
that,
juices?
That's
and
another thing that has contributed tremendously.
Oh, just because they're not, oh, they're also just not even, not hard even foods, they're not even, yeah, they're not chewing, they're eating
but
too
you,
fast. And
yeah, and so when I have people who, they want to argue with me about the smoothie, I say, okay, okay, this is fine, then hold it in your mouth for 10 seconds first, so at least that we can get some of that mixing with saliva and that the digestive process can get started properly. Because without that, then you're not going to digest it well.
And this is particularly in the kind of, I guess, modern alternative health scene where people have adopted these bitter, excess bitter pungent and astringent tastes.
Exactly.
And that's increased the vata in the digestion. Yep. Then they can't digest grains and they blame it on the grains, but it's their agni that's the issue.
Exactly.
And then they, and you see all these people, they'll be going mad on the sweet treats and the raw treats.
Exactly.
And they want that heavy date rich, coconut oil rich to ground them because they've created a vata state of digestion.
And
vata agni.
One of the things too that becomes very difficult with that is that as you know, when vata starts to get really high, the mind gets a little bit twisted. Very difficult to see things. So there'll be it's a slow process, partly because you can talk to somebody and they'll say they understand it, but then they'll talk themselves out of it very quickly. And I find that actually to be much more difficult than somebody who's got an alcohol problem, for example, and the pitta is very high, right? Yeah, once they get an understanding of it, they still have the process of the letting go and facing what's really bothering them under the surface. But once they do it, then the mind, you know, they'll make the decision, they'll go in that direction. But the vata will keep them in that more deranged place a lot
longer. So you're saying the pitta people have more of a sense, they realize.
It's... And the mind doesn't get quite as off in that direction.
That is more delusional. They think, oh, it could be good what I'm doing. They don't realize the severity of what's happening. Okay, cool. And what do you deal with a lot of people with alcohol? I mean, there's... Okay, she's nodding yes.
Yeah.
But there's people obviously binge drinking and strong alcoholics, but what I see a lot of people, and I'm sure you do, is people are drinking a glass of wine every night after their meal. And whether it's wine in India, it's yogurt. At night, they have to have yogurt on their rice, especially South India. So without that, it's incomplete. And maybe, again, in the West, a coffee. But talk about, the alcohol at night. Because it's something people don't realize. And, you know, we've heard red wine's good and a lot of...
Yes.
It's something that people really need to become aware, because they're not aware of this is quite an issue on the physiology of having a glass of red wine, for example, every night.
Right.
Or 5 times a week even. It's still a lot.
Right, exactly. Well, if you take those 5 times and you add it up, it starts to become really significant. And a lot of times people, sometimes they don't realize it. And so I talk to them about it, okay, so you realize, because oftentimes it's not just one glass. Maybe it's a very large glass, which is a half a bottle of wine. And so getting a little reality check on how much of that's going on. And then we start to see, sometimes some people can just stop that. They'll go, oh, right. And then they go ahead and stop. And they say, somebody in a laboratory said it was really good for you, but that doesn't mean that they've considered the whole picture. And I think that's the thing that really helps people wake up, is that, they say, well, it helps me relax. And it's like, well, let's find some other ways to help you relax and not tax your liver so much. And if there's not a real addiction going on, then they'll be able to stop. But it's the person who really wants to stop and can't stop that, they need some additional help. So we can help them with Ayurveda and yoga and then usually something like 12-step recovery and things like that can help them with that process also really good.
Okay. And definitely the first thing is they have to want to stop.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. If they don't, because often I have people that they'll be drinking at that level, like you mentioned, and sometimes they would say, well, maybe I'll cut it down a little bit. And then you see. And quite a few times now I've had people, you know, then maybe 6 months or a year later they'll come back and they'll go, I don't know, and I'm having more problems and I can't clear up these other digestive problems. And I said, well, you know, you can't do that and keep this alcohol going.
Yeah. What is it actually doing on the physiology, having a glass of wine or drinking like this?
Well, what it, first of all, if you think about it, then it's, it has sugar in it. Yep, and the alcohol is an irritant. It's going to aggravate pitta. And so this, that alone is usually enough. People will start to show symptoms. Some of the common ones are the eyes will start to bother them, you know, the excess heat in the eyes. And they'll often have heartburn and things like that. Yeah.
Okay. And I just want to say, yes, wine can be good for you. And in Ayurveda, we give wines as medicine, but the dose is less than the glass of wine.
That's
it's about
right.
25 milliliters twice a day.
Right.
And it's
also
many herbs.
Much less potent also.
Yeah.
The the alcohol content will be about 25% rather than 80 or 100.
Okay.
Yeah.
And coffee addiction, is that
similarly
affects the pitta like
exactly,
alcohol.
But it also affects the vata with the stimulant.
Yeah.
And then, you know, also, and especially people who already have a spiritual nature, but then they have this stimulant going in them all the time and they wonder why their practices aren't taking them where they really would like to go. You know, you can't do that. You know, you can't put a stimulant in you and expect to be really calm. And the more practices, for example, yoga practices that you do, its purpose is to clear things out, right? It's to clear out the old energy that's in the way, you might say, of our having a sense of our true self, of our eternal spirit, and that ability to connect to that. You know, we need to be able to come to a place of stillness. That's pretty tough when you're putting a stimulant in there on a regular basis.
But as well as that stimulant, that stillness, what if people want strong energy or, you know?
Well, I'll give my personal experience
energy.
On that. Strong energy comes from being able to focus your energy. Now, I know people will say, oh, I drink the coffee and then I can really focus for a little while, but what it's doing to your nervous system is pretty tough. What I found that allows you to focus your energy and have more energy available to you is the practice of pranayama, and I'm not talking about every now and then, but a regular practice on an ongoing basis. I am a perfect example of that. I've been practicing pranayama in the vicinity of 29 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And I can tell you that I think it has been the most powerful part of it. Certainly how I eat and how I conduct my life, those are all very powerful things. But my ability to actually recognize things that I need to change in myself and that has been enhanced dramatically by the practice of pranayama. And it keeps vata dosha calm when it's done properly. And the way I was taught and the way I practice is that, or the way I teach people, is that there's a starting point wherever you are at that starting point. And first we bring some basic balance to the doshas and to the chakras. And then it progresses from there, and it depends on the individual. But it's a progressive thing where I'm continually challenged, but not stressed. And I think that's a really important thing to learn, because then we learn how to have better discernment on what is enough, so that I have a great deal of energy available to me, and how much of it am I going to use? And one of the things that seems to happen a great deal with people today is that we go and go and go and go and go until they crash. And then you rest a little bit and then you get up and you go again. But there's a better way to do it.
Okay. And what is, it seems you, just then I got the feeling that you prescribe a lot of different types of pranayama. So what is some?
Well, everybody starts in a similar place depending on the individual. So it might be, you know, we give four purifications. So we start with Nadi Shodhana, the alternate nostril breathing, okay, so we can help to balance the heating and cooling in the body. And then Kapalabhati, which is skull shining, only we teach it in a moderate pace, mm-hmm. not a fast pace, because we don't want to aggravate Vata with the pranayama. We want to calm Vata. And then Agni Saur, which is a fire wash. So that's where we start to introduce some breath retention. And this is a big step in calming the mind. And not everybody's ready to start at that point. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we start a little bit with some other basic conscious breathing. And then Ashvini Mudra, which is an inhale retention. Mm-hmm. Agni Saur is an exhale retention. Mm-hmm. And where we start to just get an idea of the existence of Mulabandha. Mm-hmm. And making a connection between what's at the base of my spine and what's at the top of my head.
Beautiful.
Yeah,
and I personally love, and for many people to do as well, is Nadi Shodhana, the alternate nostril breathing. That's whenever I'm on a hike, you just stop and do that, and you full recharge. And especially if you couple that with Nasya, which is inhaling medicated oil up the nose, and then do that, you're just getting so much oxygen to the brain and giving good energy. Yeah.
Right. So, and keeping good lubrication in there too.
In the brain, which is so important in today's age with screens and Wi-Fi and epidemic of degeneration of the brain and neurological disorders.
Yeah.
It's one of the most important things I feel.
The air pollution.
That as well. Okay. And what about addiction to herbs? Have you come across anything like this? It's like coffee, because coffee's like can be like a herb.
Yeah, I think, and especially people utilizing them in ways that are not from an Ayurvedic perspective. Yeah, so I call it when people start poking at things. Oh, I want more energy. I'm going to take ashwagandha, and then I'm going to take more of it when I want more energy. And, of course, that doesn't work very well. You can get that first little bit in the beginning, and then the next thing you know, you're overheating yourself. And that would depend, of course, on the individual. But I've had many people who come with some significant pitta aggravation because they're taking too much ashwagandha. And so we people do get hooked on things like that. They're just looking for anything that's going to shift the way they feel. So we always want to go back to, okay, how are you feeling? And then where would you like to be? What is the direction we can go? And sometimes you have to talk about that with people because they don't even realize that they could feel better without feeling like they have to manipulate it. So I'm always looking for ways to help people see that the body and our mind actually naturally want to come back to a state of balance. We just have to get out of the way.
Yeah, and we don't have to necessarily rely on herbs
things
or
outside.
External things. We should be able to
control.
Okay.
Yeah, and so this is where working with the breath is so powerful. So, it might start with just some guided breathing and working with somebody with their breath and let them feel it so that they have that direct experience and that helps to validate it for them.
Okay, so we'll wrap up soon, but just to really give people more steps of action to take, let's go back to the food. Just how can people, as well as increasing sattva and pranayama, how can people prevent themselves from falling into food addictions and cravings? Obviously have a balanced diet and have all the six tastes and not have other tastes.
And that's
in excess.
That's right. Not have other tastes in excess. That's where having those six tastes in a balanced way. So, looking at them from a standpoint of augmenting and extractive, we call it. And so, augmenting is primarily the things that have the sweet taste as their primary taste. Salty, sour are things we need too, and they're augmenting, but we need only small amounts of those. And then the extractive food. Is the food that is more cleansing in nature and draws things out of us, or it asks the body to give up something to digest it. So that if we have about 60% augmenting and about 40% extractive, we're going to maintain the body.
This is kind of like Brahmana and Langana?
It's kind of, exactly. Okay. Exactly, yes.
Which in classical Ayurveda means kind of building, nourishing, and also Langana is like lightening the body.
Lightening the body, that's right. Okay. Exactly. And so when we find that when people start chewing their food and don't eat between meals. Mm. And then just go, just eyeball getting a 60-40, that things will straighten out. People who have excess weight will lose weight. People who need some more weight will start to put on weight. And so bringing those proportions together are what help people to feel satiated. That because within that, you're going to have your six tastes. And then we, you know, talk about, you know, how to spice and how to help out in terms of bringing balance and supporting Agni in there.
And good fats, is that important to keep that satiation?
The
good
fats, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And so we encourage people to use ghee. And because ghee is easier for Agni than the other oils, but the other oils are good too to have some of them.
Yeah.
And that we have to use some oil in each of the dishes that we're cooking. You know, there can be the exception for that, of course. There's the person who has a lot of kapha, and that's, we might use a reduced amount. But we still need some.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we need to keep the body lubricated as well as hydrated. Yeah, the other thing, too, that a lot of people are doing is over-drinking water.
Mm.
And this is also because they're trying not to eat too much.
Mm.
And but when they do that, then the vata starts to go up, and then the eating becomes even more imbalanced. Yeah. And the other one is salads.
Mm.
People say, oh, I thought they were good for me.
Mm.
Well, not really. They came about for commercial reasons and as a response to the fast food industry.
Yeah.
And you know, they're very difficult to digest and not particularly nutritious. Mm. And they're raw, and so it's difficult to digest.
Yeah.
And so we really encourage people to move away from that because people eating salads all the time, they end up wanting to eat sugar.
For sure.
And then they get the addiction to sugar gets going.
Yeah.
So bringing that balance of the tastes and the proportions of food back and chewing and not eating between meals, and that really starts to take care of things.
Yeah. Really, I want to emphasize how you eat, because even when you look at the Shastras, the classical texts, it's all most, like Charaka's, which is one of the sages, 10 principles, most of them is how you eat. As you said, don't eat until the previous meal's been digested. Eat relaxed. Don't eat too slow. You know, eat with the right settings. So that's a big one. And if you actually relax and dine, then you feel satiated, you feel nourished, you don't crave something half an hour later or something.
That's right. You know, and that says a lot for, we actually have certain meals of the week where everybody stays in silence.
Mm.
And, you know, then we have some nice conversation afterwards.
Mm.
And everyone who does that finds that it's a little uncomfortable at first, and then you start to realize that, oh, I'm digesting better, I feel better afterwards.
Mm.
And it's really a beautiful thing. And so that would suggest that noisy restaurants are not a great idea for digestion. Yeah. And of course, you know, always bringing that sacred nature back into the eating process. So saying a prayer or a mantra or some statement of appreciation before and after the meal it makes a big difference in the digestion.
Totally. Digestion and your mental well-being is eating and cooking is like a yagya.
Yeah.
Sacred offering to yourself and the divine being. And I just thought of this, but I've heard you're quite into also blending Ayurveda with astrology, Vedic astrology.
Yeah.
You personally you're checking your cosmic calendar a lot and making sure
We check the calendar regularly. We also acknowledge the planets on a daily basis. Mm. We do that by the clothing that we wear and the colors.
Ah, very nice. So
yeah, that's a lot of fun, actually. Yeah.
Today is
more red because it's the day of the sun.
Surya, yeah, beautiful.
Yeah, so that's something that's really fun, but it also just gets you to think about it.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So what are those each of those planets? What is their effect and that kind of thing? And what kind of relationship can I have with them? And and so we do. We try to just have a sense. We practice Agnihotra, and we do other yagya every day. And with that, so we just want to keep a sense of nature. We follow the cycle of the moon as well. And, you know, these are just little things. They don't take up a lot of time in life, but they make a lot of difference in how we feel. You know, when I first started doing yagya at The thing that I noticed.
Explain what yagya is.
Yeah. So the word yagya actually means an offering, or some people define it as a surrender, which I personally like that actually. Mm. It's like, oh yeah, I can always let go of something.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also, it can be a fire ceremony where you make an offering into the fire ceremony. Mm. And Agnihotra is a fire ceremony that anyone can do. Mm. It's to be done in the home, and it's a small fire, and we burn cow dung, and we make an offering of rice and ghee into the fire, and just a very short mantra.
Mm.
And there's very good scientific explanation for this, and I'm not that good at it. But but basically, what's happening is that at the sunrise, there's energies that are that's opening up on the planet, and at the sunset, then we acknowledge the close of those energies. But what I have found is that it just brings tremendous healing to the environment and to all the people in the environment. Yeah. That the heart softens, and we really started to notice. I say we, the people that work with me, is that when we had problems, it became easier to find the solution and things of that nature. And everybody started to be able to just feel more loving. And that's really nice. The other great benefit of it is that it's a very good protection for radiation. And so that's always a nice thing.
Yeah, in today's age. But I highly recommend anyone check that out. Just find a local Agnihotra community or people who are doing it. I'm sure they're there, and contact them and ask them to join. I'm sure they will be absolutely delighted to share with you
absolutely,
and teach you.
Yeah.
And it's such a, as Myra mentioned, those sunset and sunrise, those transitioning times we call sandhya, they're powerful. It's where greater power is there, and anything that you do at that time has greater power. So we can hitchhike on those, and when we do this this Agnihotra, it's such a beautiful way to stabilize and purify and so many things. So.
Yeah, you can go to agnihotra.org too, and there's a large group of people, and they can connect you with people
beautiful.
In your area as well.
Cool, okay. And now you're how many years have you been in Hawaii?
Just 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Just, okay.
It's 20, literally, almost
okay,
to the day, it turned out.
So that's where you started your Ayurvedic practice and teaching?
No, actually, I started prior to that in California, and then I was in Arizona for 4 years, and then I went to Hawaii for 20.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're moving to New Zealand?
And we are, yes.
You're moving everything to New Zealand, or are you going to have Hawaii
everything.
As well? Wow.
No. We're
where in New
going
Zealand?
And to the Northland, around Kerikeri in the Bay of Islands. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
Why?
So,
why the move there?
The move there is a couple of reasons. We wanted to be able to expand, and we weren't able to do that in Hawaii.
Okay.
We actually didn't operate legally there, unfortunately. Oh. And so we'd like to operate legally,
that's
and
good. You can
that's
do that
nice.
In New Zealand.
And also, it's gotten a little bit difficult to come into the United States for a lot of people. And we found that it would be easier for New Zealand to get a tourist visa and that kind of thing is a little
beautiful.
Easier.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah. If people want to visit you there, how can they?
They can come to halepule.com
okay.
and find out about what's happening. Yeah, that's our website. And we have a very large blog with a lot of information and resources in it. There's a big library there. And we'll be updating there. And we're also on Facebook and Instagram as well.
Cool.
And and so we'll be developing our new place there and we're starting out in November. We have a chef training, and we'll continue from there.
Okay, and you offer Panchakarma there? Will you be offering?
Yes, okay. Exactly. Yeah, so we'll be offering Panchakarma and dosha balancing treatments and private immersions.
Wonderful.
So we offer.
And how much Shodhana therapy, purification therapy, do you do with the Panchakarmas?
As much as we can.
Okay.
In other words, we have people actually start at home and start the process there. But we do all of the treatments except Rakta Mokshana. We don't do so.
But you can. I mean, Australia leeches are very used. I'm not sure about New Zealand, but you can maybe see.
Yes, maybe actually. Yeah,
there's big medical. At least 30 hospitals in New South Wales alone use it.
Is that right?
Wow. Yeah, it's very popular for surgery and
even
in Europe, because there's no better anticoagulant known to man than what the leech has.
Right.
So people get their nose stitched back on. They're like, well, we have to put a leech on because we don't know how to get the blood there better. So, but it's, you can
great.
See. Okay, well, I think that's everything. Anything okay. else you want to say?
No.
Beautiful.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank
it's
you so
really
much.
Great.
Yeah.
Namaste.
Namaste. Can we end with some chant or mantra or anything
sure.
you would like to?
Sure, yeah. Okay. Om Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Amritam Gamaya Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi.